The subject that we're going to cover today is just one small section of the marriage relationship, but it's such an important aspect of building a relationship between a husband and a wife that we've picked that of all the number of topics that we could have picked to try and squeeze into an hour and a half seminar, the subject of communications. I heard a story recently that is supposed to be true. There was an ad appeared in an Atlanta paper advertising a Porsche for sale for $75. Now, those of you here who know what a Porsche is and the value of that kind of a automobile know that it would have to be pretty ancient and pretty beat up and pretty antiquated in order to be worth only $75. Well, the ad appeared for 3 or 4 days running, and nobody called or answered it because everybody had the same reaction. It must have meant $7,500 rather than $75, which would have been right in the ballpark because it was a fairly recent vintage. But finally, one guy called on the ad, and a lady on the other end of the phone answered, and he said, I understand you have a Porsche for sale for $75? She says, yes, that's right. He said, that is the right price, yes, $75. Well, what's wrong with it? Nothing. Does it have an engine? Yes. Does it run? Yes. Well, has it been in an accident and badly beat up? No, it's in perfect running order. Well, I'd like to come out and look at it. And she said, fine, and told him that she'd be there that afternoon. So he came out and looked at it. It was beautiful. So he asked her if he could drive it around the block. Sure, go ahead. So he did. Came back and said, are you sure the price is $75? That's right. I'll take it. So he peeled off $75, gave it to her. Started to walk back toward the car. And he thought, I've got to find out why. So he walked back to the front door, rang the bell. She came out and he says, listen, lady, I really feel I've got to buy, but I've got to know why in the world you're selling this car for $75. She says, oh, that's easy. My husband left me about 2 months ago for a younger woman. And I got a letter from him last week asking me to sell the Porsche and send him the money. Now, folks, they had a communications problem. Whether that was the real reason behind him leaving her for a younger woman, I'm not sure. But they apparently didn't know how to communicate very well. And the more Carol and I talk to couples who have entered into this fantastically exciting experience of marriage, we are finding that as time goes by, the communication links between husbands and wives begin to deteriorate. And those who are in the business of professional counseling tell us, we are not in that business ourselves, but they tell us that the number one cause of separation and eventually leading to divorce between husbands and wives is the matter of communication. Some links begin to break down in this area. And so it's the reason that we've picked this particular aspect of the marriage relationship out of a number that we could have chosen to build this particular seminar around. Now, let me make some introductory comments, and then Carol is going to come up and share with us some of the things that she has on her heart and some of the technical aspects involved in communications. And I'd like to turn back to the book of Ephesians again. We're going to stick with that. George started us in chapter 4. We're going to skip over to chapter 5. And he has already given the background this morning for us. And it's interesting to me to note that this very graphic and beautiful passage on marriage, which is probably the most outstanding passage in all of the scripture on the marriage relationship found in Ephesians 5, is couched in the middle of what George pointed out to us is related to the walk of the believer. This is how we ought to act in a specific God-given situation, that of marriage. Now, God invented marriage. It wasn't man's idea. I realize that many of the books you read today, you kind of put it down and you walk away from it and you get the idea. You know, that guy kind of feels that man himself invented this thing called marriage. And he didn't. God invented it. I wish we had the time to go back into Genesis chapter 2 and take a look at the early beginnings of that. If you want to get the tapes, well, you can listen to that on the tape. But it's a fascinating account of what happened between Adam and Eve and how God brought all this into being. Well, this is a further unfolding from God's perspective of what the marriage relationship ought to be like. And I just want to call your attention to a couple of thoughts that are mentioned here in Ephesians chapter 5 related to this. Beginning with verse 23. For the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ is the head of the church, his body, and is himself its Savior. Then from there it goes on, and it talks both to husbands and wives, this passage. But after that statement, three times in the next few verses, it mentions that husbands are to love their wives. And guys, this is not optional as you read it in this passage. From God's perspective, there are no if clauses regarding a husband loving his wife. It is a command. Even as it is a command here that the husband is to be the head of the wife. That's God's plan. Now, basically what headship is referring to here is leadership. It is my responsibility as a husband under God's authority to assume the leadership for the relationship that Carol and I have together. Now, we can't go into all the details of what that means in this short a time, but let me point out just one thing that it means, particularly as it relates to the area of communication. Now, a leader in any kind of a situation has two basic responsibilities. Number one, he is to watch out for the welfare of the people for whom he is responsible. A leader obviously has followers. He has people he is leading. And therefore, one of his primary responsibilities is to watch out for their welfare. Because if he loses them, he's out of business. His second responsibility is to accomplish the goals, the objective, or the mission for which that group of people has been put together. Now you see this beautifully portrayed in Psalm 78, 70 through 72, when it's talking about King David. God chose David also his servant, and took him from the sheepfolds. From following the ewes, great with young, he brought him to lead Jacob his people and Israel his inheritance. And so it says, and David led them according to the integrity of his heart and guided them by the skillfulness of his hands. He led them out of the integrity of his heart. He had a heart relationship with them that was constantly looking out for their well-being. And he guided them by the skillfulness of his leadership, his hands, toward the goals and the objectives which God had laid on his heart for the people of Israel. It's probably the outstanding passage on the two basic responsibilities of a leader in all of the Scripture. And that's what I have as a husband. Now, accompanying that, there are certain basic principles of leadership that if I, as a husband, will follow and maintain and work at, I am going to be successful in the responsibility that God has given me as a husband. Now notice in that passage, verse 23 there, it says, the husband is the head of the wife as what? As Christ is the head of the church. In other words, he is to be my example. as to what headship is really all about. All right, let's take the area of communications. Who initiated communications between mankind and God? God or man? God did, huh? Everybody agree on that? Those agree, that put your hands up. Okay, those that disagree. Okay, I don't think everybody voted. Some of you are afraid to vote. Okay, God initiated communications as a leader, as taking the responsibility and the oversight for the human race. Okay, now if he is to be my example, then gentlemen, those of you here who are husbands, and I'm assuming that most of you are, whose responsibility is the initiation of communication in your relationship between you and your wife? Who has that responsibility? Christ is our example as the head of the church. Who initiated communications between Christ and the church? Christ did. Okay, if he's my example, then who has the responsibility for initiating communications in the marriage relationship? The husband. Guys, I'm sorry, but I don't see that there's any way we can squeeze out of that one. Who maintained communications between Christ and his church? Who continues to take the initiative? Who left behind a whole book by which we can continue to communicate and understand the thoughts and the ideas and concepts that God wants to communicate to us? He left this for us. He continues to take the initiative. As George was talking about this morning, when the curtain was rent in the temple and it made available to us access to the very throne room of God through prayer, he continued to take the initiative in maintaining communication. And if he is my example as a husband, then it is my responsibility not only to initiate, but continue to take the responsibility for maintaining communication. Now, what does that mean in practical terms? Well, does it mean that you gals just sit there and wait for your husbands to talk? No, I don't think so. See, there is a difference between having the responsibility and always carrying out that which the responsibility entails. Carol doesn't sit around waiting for me to initiate communication. We have created in our relationship an atmosphere that is permissive. We feel the freedom to communicate on any subject with one another at any time, either one of us. However, if there comes a time when communications are obviously breaking down, where we need to talk about something, I have the responsibility to see that that is done. That's what this means. That's what we're talking about. For instance, several years ago, I was given a job working with the navigators that entailed quite a bit of travel. And it was the first time that I'd really done much traveling. Prior to that, I'd stayed home most of the time, and it was unusual for me to be gone for even a couple of days. But now I was gone 2 and 3 weeks at a time. And I would come home, and all the time that I was gone, I would be with people. From the time I get up in the morning, the time I went to bed at night, it was people, people, people. And I don't know how you are, but when that goes on for a certain length of time, I just get tired of people. I love the human race. It's people I can't stand, you know, that type of thing. And I would come home, and the last thing in the world I wanted to do was talk. But Carol had been home for 2 or 3 weeks, you know, speaking with the dog, interviewing Lynn, our young daughter, dial a prayer once in a while, carrying on delightful conversations with the washing machine, that type of thing. And what did she want to do? Man, she wanted to hear all about the 3-week trip that I'd just taken. Well, The atmosphere was a little bit tense that evening when I would arrive home because I didn't want to talk. I just wanted to come home and flop, lay in the middle of the living room floor, stare up at the ceiling, watch the boob tube, relax, get a good night's sleep in my own bed. But she wanted to hear all about it. Well, this happened 3 or 4 times. I went away, she stayed home, I came home, she was there, I didn't want to talk, she wanted to hear all about it. After about the fourth time, well, the fourth or fifth time that it happened, she had invited company over for dinner the night I got home. That made us both realize we had a problem. It's the kind that I call generic in nature. It's the kind that's not going to go away. It's going to be with us from now until eternity unless something is done about it, because I was going to keep traveling. She was going to keep staying home. I was going to keep coming home. Hopefully she'd be there waiting. And we had a problem when I hit the front door. Well, once we recognized we had a problem, we had to talk about it. And that's what we find a lot of couples don't do. They let something like that go on and on and on and on. And it keeps getting worse. A little more irritation wears into it each go around. And it's going to happen next week and next month and the following month. And nothing is done about it. And pretty soon it's something that they just stare daggers at one another. It's gotten to the point where they don't even dare talk about it anymore. It's such an explosive issue. But we realized after this happened about the fourth or the fifth time that we had a problem and it wasn't going to go away. We were going to have to face it every time I got home. So we started talking about it. And we talked about it on and off over a period of several days, probably over a couple of week period of time. An hour here, an hour there, a few minutes here, a few minutes there. We prayed about it together. We prayed about it individually. And what we were trying to do was get to an understanding of how one another felt. Because, see, Carol never knew how I felt. She'd never been on a trip with me. She didn't know what it was like. And so I had to express to her why I felt the way I did when I got home. I didn't understand her because I'd never stayed home for 3 weeks by myself. And the emotions and the pent-up feelings that had began to build in her. And she got all those out, and I got all my feelings out. So we began to come to a mutual understanding of how one another felt about this situation. And once we got that far, then we could begin to come to grips with, okay, how can we resolve it? What's the solution that also is generic in nature that'll solve this problem every time we face it? But see, gang, communications was the key. We had to talk about it. We had to give one another the opportunity to express how we really felt about that situation in order to get to the point where we could talk about solutions. And finally we did. We sat down one evening and began to talk about how we could resolve this. And once we understood one another, the solution came very easily. And we resolved it very simply. Here was our solution to that problem. I'm sure that some of you face the same thing and maybe come to the same conclusion. We agreed that in order to satisfy my need of just having an evening to relax, to unwind, to do anything I wanted to, if I didn't want to talk, I didn't have to. The night I got home, I didn't have to talk. She agreed to this. She understood now how I felt, and she was willing to forego that first evening. We also agreed we'd never have anybody over for dinner that first night I got home. And it was kind of my evening. I could call the shots. If I wanted to do something, why, we would do it, you know. But in order to meet her need of wanting to hear all about it and of interacting and asking questions, and of course Carol is a very detail-oriented person, and she wants to know all the nitty-gritty, you know, every little detail. And I am not that way. I'm more conceptual in my thinking, and I look at the big picture and I can boil something down to 5 minutes that would take her an hour. That's just the way we are. We're different. I'm sure that none of you are that way. And by the way, we try to capitalize on those differences. And we look upon them as assets rather than liabilities. It makes a tremendous difference in your attitude toward those things. So, to meet her need, I agreed that I would sit down and talk with her about the trip and answer all of her questions within 24 hours after I got home. And she could wait, you know, another few hours, and that satisfied her need. It met both of our needs, and we resolved the problem. We've never had it since. But the key was communications. We had to be willing to talk about it and get our feelings out to one another and allow one another the opportunity to express their feelings and to listen with sincere and genuine interest. Well, that's just kind of an introduction to the importance of this business of communications. I'm going to ask Carol to come up now and share some things that she has. And it's always, you've already met her, you've heard her speak. She's a terrific gal. She's a wonderful mother. She's my lover. She's the mother of my daughter, who you also have seen around here. We are expecting a grandchild next April. We're excited about that. I don't know how it's going to be married to a grandmother, but we're both looking forward to it. But I think the thing that Carol and I appreciate most about one another is that over the years, as we have worked at this marriage relationship, and I wish we had the time to take to tell you what that means to us, to work at developing a relationship. There's an awful lot involved in that little statement. But one of the things that has resulted out of our being willing to work at it is that we have truly, in an absolute sense of the word, become best friends. And I think the thing that is more exciting to me than anything else is to be able to introduce you to my best friend, Carol.
And happiness is being married to your very best friend. A while ago, Jack and I, just before dinner time, were sitting in the living room, and I turned to him and I said, well, imagine that. Everyone in our household has plans for dinner tonight. Well, Jack has been married to me for some 28 years now. And so he knows me pretty well. And he looked at me and he kind of grinned and he said, I suppose that means you want me to take you out for dinner? And it did. And he did. But as I thought about that afterwards, I thought, now how come I didn't just say, honey, everybody in our household has plans for dinner. Why don't we go out for a hamburger? But because I'm the way I am, I wouldn't have said that. And I probably, if he hadn't have picked up my little clue the way he did, I probably would have stirred the soup thinking, he doesn't understand me. Did you ever do that? Communication is not easy. In fact, it's so hard. I've got to read a little article to you called From Jelly Side Down by Nancy Stahl. She says, every once in a while I become a bit broody that my role as an exotic enchantress has become something of a bit part. Not that I expect my husband's nostrils to flare whenever the hem of my skirt brushes his knee. I don't even expect him to quiver with erotic delight when I scratch the place on his back that he can never reach. But I have the uncomfortable feeling every evening that if I greeted him at the door stark raving naked, he would tell me that I have lipstick on my teeth. What I object to most is that, unless one counts the sparkling one-sided conversations I carry on with the dog, the cryptic remarks I address to the washing machine, and the occasional chat with a dial of prayer, I spend 10 hours of every day virtually incommunicado. By evening, I am sobbingly eager to be recognized for the gay, witty nymph I really am, and perhaps engage in a spot of repartee. How was your day? I began last night, addressing my opening gambit to the back of the sports page. Did you have a good lunch? I'm having the roof reshingled with gold-plated clamshells, I remarked casually. The TV repairman is madly in love with me. We're running off together next Wednesday morning, right after I get back from Weight Watchers. to me, I finally shrieked. He stared at me as if I had just demanded he shave his legs. I've been talking to you. You haven't been talking. You've been mmming. You haven't heard a word I've said, I complained. I've heard everything you've said, he argued. By the way, you have lipstick on your teeth. Sometimes that's the way we feel, isn't it? I said to the wall, wall. And you feel like you are talking to a wall. You are not communicating. Now, friends, some of us are naturally revealers of our personalities. I happen to be one of those kind of people. It's not hard for me to tell my feelings. But a number of you are very naturally concealers of your feelings. Jack was, to some extent, when we got married. He had to learn, for my sake, and for other people's as well, to be a revealer. Because it's very important in communication to go down to the level of feeling. And I know, depending on our backgrounds and so on, it's harder for some of you to be revealers. But I read about one man who knew that he was a concealer in his personality, and he had to come to the grips that his wife needed much more than that from him. And so he concluded that really for him, not to be a revealer of his feelings was sin. It was the sin of selfishness. And with him, he had to come to a place before God that he said, Lord, this is sin. I want to be unselfish. And so with your help, I am going to commit myself for whatever it takes to learn to communicate at a depth level. Friends, God is fabulous. God is fabulous. He has wonderful things to teach us and wonderful things for us in our relationships with our sweethearts. And sometimes, you know, you're looking at a stubborn Dutchman. My name was Hooksema before I was married. Okay? Now, I could let that be a detriment, couldn't I? I could say, well, I'm stubborn. That's just the way I am. But isn't it wonderful that the God who made me can change me? And he can root out that characteristic that isn't a very lovely characteristic. So you who are concealers in your personalities, ask a creative God for creative ideas to learn to be a revealer and commit yourself to that. And we'll be talking about some practical ways this morning as to how this might be accomplished. Dwight Small says in his book, Design for Christian Marriage, this statement, how suddenly holy wedlock can become unholy deadlock. And it's true, isn't it? Our marriages can either be a duel or a duet, sometimes both, depending on when we look in on them. And yet, someone has once said that you don't have the wages of happiness without working for them. You can't know anyone unless you communicate with them. You can't love anything you don't know. Therefore, the depth of love existing between a husband and a wife will largely depend on the amount and depth of their communication. Now, when we're speaking of communication this morning, we're speaking not just of verbalizing, not just of listening. We're talking about what goes into understanding between the two. And that's where we get into trouble. Because most of us are on entirely different wavelengths. Because Jack and I are so different in our personalities. And that's a whole other subject. Mm-hmm. Stop laughing. No. We are on different wavelengths completely, and we could pass each other in the night and in the daytime too. Now, thinking together is much more important than thinking alike. In fact, what makes us strong is the fact that we don't think alike. We see things from two different viewpoints. And as we communicate about those, it makes both of our viewpoints stronger. Do you see that? Beautiful the way God made most of us. Different. But those very differences will drive us right up a wall unless we understand them. And in order to understand them, we have to communicate. So thinking alike is not essential, but thinking together, bringing our wavelengths together in constant understanding is what we're after. Our goal is to be best friends. Our objective, real intimacy. Because of that, Jack and I find that we have to constantly ask each other the questions, what do you really mean by that? This is how I'm understanding what you're saying. And use what is known as the feedback technique. You've heard that term. But just to really ask Jack what he's meaning. Now, some of it's ridiculous, really, that we're not understanding each other. For instance, Jack will come home, and he will say to me, what time is dinner? Now, what would you women think that he meant by that? Anybody? He's hungry. Is that what you think, most of you? And so you'd be hurrying up dinner? Exactly wrong. Jack is a jogger. And what he is really saying is, do I have time to run before dinner? So unless I understand that, I'm hurrying up dinner when he wants it delayed. And there we are. Now he is learning to say, do I have time to run before dinner? But we are constantly in the business of coding messages and uncoding messages with one another, aren't we? And that's why we need these questions. What do you mean? What are you really saying? Are you hungry? You see, there are six messages involved in the communication process. What you mean to say, what you actually say, what the other person hears, what the other person thinks he hears, what the other person says about what you said, and what you think the other person said about you said, what you said. Now, you see how that gets complicated? One night, we were looking at a big, beautiful moon, and I said, isn't that a beautiful moon? Now, what was I saying, really? Well, I was saying, oh, that moon makes me feel so romantic. And Jack responded, yes, that's bright enough to shoot a golf ball by. He grinned when he said it, because he really knew what I was saying. But let's use that as an example. Okay, what did I mean to say? Well, I meant to say, I am feeling romantic. What I actually said was, that is a beautiful moon. What Jack may have heard is, the moon is bright. So what he thinks he hears is, it's a nice night to take a walk in the bright moon. So what he says about what I said is, yes, that's bright enough to shoot a golf ball by. And what I think he's saying is, I don't feel romantic. And you see, in two sentences, we go all the way through these six things, and we miss each other completely. You would not believe how much you do that without even being aware of what you're doing. You got those? can't. Now, too often we talk, we concentrate on the talking aspect of communication. The essential part of communication is to listen with understanding. Paul Tournier has said, "How beautiful, how grand and liberating this experience is when people learn to help each other. It is impossible to overemphasize the immense need humans have to be really listened to. Listen to all the conversations of our world, between nations as well as those between couples. They are for the most part dialogues of the deaf." Now Proverbs 18:13 says, "He who answers a matter before he hears it, it is folly and shame to him." Friends, I think probably God has helped me in this area more through memorizing his word than any other one area of communication. Because I am a natural talker. You know, sometimes I feel like I set my mouth off and just leave it running. And I don't like that about myself. But nevertheless, that's what I am. And I'm working on it, and God's working on it. But we're going slow. But because I'm a talker, I find sometimes it difficult to really listen through to someone else. And I find myself sort of mentally perched on the edge of my chair, just waiting for that person to finish so I can get my 2 cents worth in. And then I memorized Proverbs 18, verse 2, which says in the Revised, "A fool takes no pleasure in understanding, but only in expressing his opinion." Ugh. And so there I am, mentally perched on the edge of my chair, just waiting for somebody to finish what they're saying, or even ready to interrupt when they take a deep breath. And God says, "Carol, a fool takes no pleasure in understanding, but only in expressing her opinion." And how beautiful that God said that to my heart, to my life, and I can say, "All right, Lord, help me. Help me to really listen and understand." One of the greatest ministries that you can have in another's life, your husband and your wife, is to really listen with understanding. And the only one who truly understands that person that you're living with in marriage is God. Because God made them, huh? Do you pray for understanding every day for your mate? Should. Do you pray for a deeper love for your mate every day? You should. True love has no maximum. And we'll grow in our love. You know, I thought when I walked down the aisle 28 years ago, and my heart was just almost bursting with love. And I thought, oh, wow. I could never love Jack any more than I love him today. And I was wrong. I love him much more today than I loved him 28 years ago. True love has no maximum. As we grow together in Christ, in an understanding with one another. Now, if you're not being listened to, you may want to just pray Psalm 139, 23, and 24 that we prayed a little bit before today. "Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my ways, and see if there be any wicked way in me, and lead me into the way everlasting." Because maybe there's something that you are doing. Maybe you're being habitually a nagger, critical, harping on things, talking too much, and therefore have discouraged someone that you love, that's close to you, from listening. I read this little excerpt in a book called 1 plus 1 equals 1. And the author says, a defiant woman said to me once, I'd just like to see you talk to my husband. I'd just like to see it. There's no way that it can be done. She went on to say that when he was at home, he either had his nose in the newspaper, he was glued to the television, or he was asleep. I might as well just not even be there. She said that occasionally, when she just had to, she would grab him by the shoulders, look him straight in the face, and say, now you are going to listen to me. She sighed, then said, when I get all through, do you know what he says? All I get out of him is the little grunt. That's all. Just a grunt. Well, I listened to that woman. For almost 45 minutes straight, I listened, and I had a great feeling of sympathy for that husband. He knew very well what he was doing. The newspaper, the television, the quick nap, what wonderful escape mechanisms they were. She had the most unpleasant combination of shrill nasal tones, hypercritical attitude, and nonstop pace I have ever encountered. The thought of being subjected to that the first thing each morning and the last thing each night would chill even the implacable scientific social worker. One might even look upon deafness with a certain amount of interest. This husband had done the next best thing. He had perfected what is known as occupational deafness. I used to talk to her, a silent husband once explained, you know, about my job and all that. I would start to explain a problem I might have, but she would always cut me off. That reminds me, she would interrupt, and be off on some tangent. All that my talking did was to give her a springboard for some topic of her own. She wasn't interested in what I wanted to say. You couldn't blame him, yet she didn't mean any harm. It was just that she was so undisciplined that her mind would be triggered off by any word association, and her tongue simply trailed along. A fool takes no pleasure in understanding, but only in expressing his opinion. Now, friends, a lot of the things that Jack and I are sharing today are really, we feel, impossible apart from God. Apart from letting God really speak to your life and to your heart. Apart from letting him change you. These things are impossible. But nothing is impossible with God. Some of you have already built walls in your marriage. Walls so high that you can't climb over them yourself. And you need the help of God to tear those walls down. To forgive. To forget, and to start all over again. But God is fabulous, and he is eager to do that for you. Now, there are certain barriers that we throw up in the communication process. We'll take a hypothetical couple called Bill and Sue, Elmer and Sue, and shows what some of these problems can be. One night, Sue says to Elmer, honey, I'd really like to talk to you about something that's been bothering me lately. And Elmer counters with, not now, Sue. There's a football game on TV I've been wanting to watch. Let's talk later. You heard about the husband who had his hand on the TV knob, and he took to his wife, and he says, honey, is there anything you want to say before football season starts? Sometimes wives feel that way. Somehow after dinner, Elmer had some business that had to be taken care of and an important telephone call to make, and after that, he was just too tired. Unconsciously, perhaps, he was blocking any real communication by being too busy. So, 2 weeks later, Elmer comes in discouraged and upset. He's been wrestling with a personnel problem at work, and he wants to talk it out with Sue. But just it gets well into the incident, Sue interrupts with, "Honey, did you remember to pay that telephone bill yesterday?" She has effectively told him that she's not interested by changing the subject and not dealing with the issue in hand. I'm afraid we wives especially are quite prone to do this. So Elmer carries his problem alone. But the personnel problem doesn't dissolve, and he becomes very irritable. So one night he tries again to reach her, and he says, "Honey, you really don't seem very interested in my problems at work." She looks kind of stricken and then angry. And then she says, "Oh, you don't think so? Well, you don't listen to my problems either. How about the time I was trying to tell you about that and you didn't even listen?" She has used a very effective defense against communication, and that is defensiveness. We come back completely defensive. Now, friends, it takes maturity not to be defensive, because it's a very natural response. You hurt me, I'll hurt you back. It takes wisdom from God to be able to say, "Hey, you're right. I'm sorry. What is it that you wanted to tell me?" So a week later, Sue says to Elmer, "You know, honey, you've only spent 15 minutes with the kids this week, and even less with me. I really feel you need to give us more time." And Elmer comes back with, "Oh, you're right. I'm the world's worst father and husband. How do you put up with me anyway? I really am a failure." He has used a block called super guilt. Dr. Mallory, a Christian Conflict Center in Atlanta, suggests that anybody who feels this guilty has no intention of changing. Because if they had any intention of changing, they wouldn't feel as guilty. Is that one of your defenses? It has been mine. Another defense or a block is the husband or the wife will say, "Oh, you're right. Do it any way you want to. Yeah, you're perfectly right. And what you're doing and always giving in and not really explaining your feelings is peace at any price. Because you're not getting down to the heart of that problem. You're not talking about it. You're just giving in." Both wives and husbands can be very guilty of this. So a little later, Elmer says to Sue, "You know, I really am feeling like a failure in my work and as a husband and father. I'm feeling very ineffective in my life." And Sue responds with a response that many of us give. "Oh, you shouldn't feel that way. Oh, don't feel that way. I just said that this morning." Then I realized that that is really not accepting another's feeling, is it? They do feel that way. There's no point in saying don't feel that way, because that's the way they feel. And I need to not only accept how they're feeling, but understand how they're feeling. And just by listening can help. Now, one that I am very prone for is when something's wrong between Jack and me. He can read me like a book. I'm very transparent. And so he comes home and he's done something that I haven't really appreciate it. And he will come in and he'll say, "Hi, honey. Hello. Anything wrong?" "No." "You sure?" "Yes." "Well, what am I doing?" "Well, I'm using silence as a tool. Silence as a tool to hurt. And I'm doing it very deliberately. And friends, it's absolutely immature. And it's another word, one that God and I are working on together. Nothing is wrong should be three words that are stricken from a married couple's vocabulary. Truly. Now there are a few times when really there isn't anything wrong. Believe it or not, I really am just feeling silent. Very seldom, but sometimes. But what do I need to say? Well, I need to tell Jack that. "Honey, there really isn't anything wrong. I'm just in a silent mood. I'm not sure why." Or, "Yes, there is something wrong, but it has nothing to do with you." Or, "Yes, there is something wrong, but if I tell you now, I'm going to cry." Which is typical of me, too. "And so you're just going to have to wait until I can control this, and then I'll tell you. And then come back to it." Always come back to it. We have got to start learning to verbalize our feelings when they're hurt, when we're hurting, when we're angry. All of these things. We've got to learn to do that. A couple came over to our house and spent several days with us and had an opportunity to observe Jack and me and us them. And one morning Jack came in and as this wife and I were doing the breakfast dishes, and he said, "Where are my keys?" And I said, "They're in the drawer." And he said, "No, those are your keys." And I said, "No, they're your keys." And we went back and forth a little bit. I just had them made. I knew they were his keys. And so finally he was convinced that they were his keys, and he said, "Thank you," and walked out. End of incident, I thought. But this wife turned to me, and she said, "Carol, I wish you'd pray for me." And I said, "Well, I'll be happy to pray for you, but how do you want me to pray?" And she said, "Well, whenever my husband asks me a question, the way Jack asked you just now, he sounds angry." And I said, "Oh, well, does he sound angry or is he angry?" You know what she said? "I don't know. I don't know." Friends, this had been going on for literally years. That she had been reading into a tone of voice from her husband, anger. And she never asked him the simple question, "Are you angry?" Now this may be an extreme case, but really as I talk to wives, it's not so extreme. We read into things. Of course, we all do that. And we think we know what someone is feeling, and we really don't have the least idea. All that wife would have had to do is say, "Are you angry?" And he could have said yes or no. And that, even the question, would have revealed to him that his tone was saying to her he was angry. And if he said yes, he was angry, her next question, being the kind of person she was, is, "Well, are you angry at me?" We always take things personally. And there again, they could have gotten it out and talked about it. Handling conflict, again, takes maturity. And the only way I know to really be mature is by knowing God, who will help you be mature. As we go down deep with God, He's going to help us grow up and be able to handle conflict. The best rule I ever came across in handling conflict, friends, is this little rule: refuse to win. Refuse to win. Because when we enter conflict with an "I win, you lose" kind of an attitude, we both lost. But when we enter conflict with a view to understanding one another better, we both won. So your rule in conflict is to understand one another, not to win. So don't use silence as a tool. Phyllis McGinley states, "Sticks and stones are hard on bones aimed with angry art. Words can sting like anything, but silence breaks the heart." And it's true. There are 5 levels of communication. And lots of times we dwell in level 5, don't we? Cliche communication. Yeah, can you move? Hi, how are you? How was your day? Level 4 is reporting the facts about others. Level 3 comes down to real communication, my ideas and judgments. But friends, if you reject my ideas, if you say to me, "Oh, Carol, that's the stupidest thing you ever said," what'll I do? I'll go right back into reporting facts, won't I? Or even cliche communication. Many husbands and wives have destroyed the communication process between them by this very reason, from this very reason. Ridicule. Ask God to help you rid your marriage of ridicule. We need to accept one another. We need to learn to be vulnerable with one another. I think of all the characteristics that I appreciate about Jack is his acceptance of me. I am sort of a nut, to tell you the truth. And I come up with some harebrained ideas. But never once in our married life that I can remember. He may have thought it, but he's never said it. He's never said to me, "Oh, Carol, that's really way out. Or that's stupid." What has that done for me? It has freed me to be me. And every once in a while, I come up with a pretty good one. But mainly it has made me love Jack at a level that is something special. Because I know that Jack accepts me. Level 2 begins deep communication, my feelings. And level 1, of course, is one that we'll never reach outside of heaven. Because we're always kind of going back and forth on this scale. But level 1 is just complete empathy, sympathy, talking about things on a deep level at all times. We probably couldn't even stand that level emotionally. Let me illustrate, and then I'm through. Jack comes in and I say, "Hi, how was your day?" And he says, "Oh, fine." That's very definitely cliche communication, isn't it? So I say, "How did your meeting go this afternoon?" And he says, "Oh, fair." Reporting a fact. A very poor question, however. I hope you learn the art of questioning. It was a question that could be answered yes, no, fair. Never ask a question that can be answered by one word. What was the most interesting thing that happened to you at your meeting? What was the most frustrating thing that happened at your meeting? You know, ask something that they have to answer. So I try again, and I say, "Well, how did you feel the meeting went this afternoon? Or how did you feel about the results of the planning?" And I'm trying to get down to a feeling level. He may come back with a judgment level by saying, "Oh, in my opinion, the committee came up with the wrong answers." So I try again, and I say, "Was this frustrating to you?" And he'll say, "Yes, it really was. I wanted more, and now we're off." to some real depth level of communication. Friends, this is an adventure. We are to speak the truth in love, Ephesians 4:15 says. And if we could write that in red, to speak the truth, but always do it in love. Marry those two. Sometimes you can be brutally honest without being loving. Sometimes you think you're being loving, but you're not being honest. Real communication is speaking the truth in love. And it's an adventure that we will be working at for the rest of our lives, won't we? Because we're always changing. And that's so neat. I love the little excerpt from Why I'm Afraid to Tell You Who I Am. When he says this, my person is not a little hard core inside of me, a little fully formed statue that is real and authentic, permanent and fixed. Person rather implies a dynamic process. In other words, if you knew me yesterday, please do not think that it is the same person you are meeting today. I have experienced more of life. I have encountered new depths in those I love. I have suffered and prayed, and I am different. Approach me then with a sense of wonder. Study my face and hands and voice for the signs of change, for it is certain that I have changed.
Over the years, Carol and I have developed some little habits that have helped us work at this matter of communication and our relationship with one another. I'm reminded of a passage in Proverbs that is a constant prick to me in working at things like this. Proverbs 10:4, he becometh poor that dealeth with a slack hand, but the hand of the diligent maketh rich. And I think our lives have been enriched and our relationship has been enriched because we have been willing to work at some of these things from a practical standpoint. One thing that we have done over the last several years is we have made it a habit of continuing to have dates with each other. We don't double date anymore. We used to when we were engaged and going together, but since we were married, we don't double date anymore for the purpose I am intending to tell you about, and that is to communicate. I don't know what your house is like, but many times we get the feeling that it's sort of like Grand Central Station in the middle of Christmas rush. The telephone, people stopping by, the neighbors, kids next door. And to try and get a quiet evening at home, just the two of us, is almost an impossibility. So over the last several years, we have gone out together on a date just to get time with one another. Sometimes it's a rather romantic setting with candlelight and, you know, steak dinner and so forth. But most of the time, it's McDonald's hamburgers or pizza. Something like that, but a place where we can go and just be by ourselves and talk, to spend some time together and get caught up. And we find that by habitually doing that, it has really helped us to get inside of one another's feelings and thinking on various parts of our lives. Now, in addition to that, over the last several years, we have also developed the habit of taking out of the day 20 minutes, 20 to 30 minutes that we spend with each other in conversation. It's kind of like having a quiet time, you know. You set a time aside to spend alone with God. Well, this is our time alone with each other. Now, over the years, that time has varied. When Lynn was small, it couldn't be at a mealtime. It had to be after Lynn was put in bed. Up until just recently, we've had people living in our home, and breakfast time was the best. They would get up early, have their breakfast. Carol and I would have breakfast together and take 20 minutes to a half an hour just sitting and talking and catching up with one another. What happened yesterday? What is going on today? What is the greatest concern in your heart? And to stay in touch with one another. Right now, at this particular time in our lives, it's the first time in, I think, almost 18 years that we have lived by ourselves, just the two of us. And it's quite a new experience for us, and we're beginning to really enjoy it and find it exciting. And so dinner time now is the time that we usually take to take this time out of the day just to share with one another. Now, don't misunderstand me. That's not the only time we talk. But it is a goal that we shoot for, that we do spend 20 minutes to 30 minutes a day talking with each other and listening to one another. I have met couples who don't spend that much time in a month. But we've got to be diligent at it. We've got to work at it. And it has enriched our relationship as a result. Now, just in closing, let me mention a couple of nevers that are related to this business of communication that we have found from our own experience over the years that we can't handle, and therefore we have eliminated from our lives, in particularly as it relates to communication. The first one is never use sarcasm in kidding and joking with one another. Now, if you don't know what I mean by sarcasm, let me give you a name, Don Rickles. You ever seen Don Rickles on television? Well, he is the epitome of the sarcastic humorist. He has perfected the art. He's making a living out of it, and probably a pretty good one. But if you notice what happens with his humor, it's always barbed, it's always pointed, and it always hurts somebody. When Carol and I were first married, we developed the little habit of joking and kidding with one another in little sarcastic quips that we would make. She would do it, I would do it. And at first, there was no harm in it. We enjoyed it. It was fun. But as time wore on, after the first couple of years, as time wore on, we began to be aware of the fact that it became a very convenient weapon to use in a very subtle way to get a barb in to the other person without them really knowing whether or not it was just humor or whether it really was barbed. Now, independent of one another, we became aware of this and that it was a growing problem, but it was such a habit with us that we didn't know what to do. And then that summer, we spent became a youth director in a church just during the summertime out in Southern California. And we were with this pastor and his wife continually during the course of the summer. We'd spend hours a week with them in various parts of our ministry and just in a very casual time of fellowship from time to time. And as the weeks wore on during that summer, we noticed their relationship. And they had a beautiful relationship with each other in their marriage. It was obvious they were madly in love with one another. They really enjoyed one another. They had a great time together. But as time went on, we also noticed that they never used sarcasm to kid with each other. So about the middle of the summer, we asked them about it. And they virtually repeated to us our story. The early years of their marriage, they had developed this little habit of kidding and joking with one another in a sarcastic way. And then it got out of hand, and they began to really hurt one another. This was what was happening to us. And so they finally came to the conclusion that it was something they could not handle. They talked about it, they prayed about it together, and they decided together to eliminate it from their communication pattern. And they did. It took them a while. We went home that night. We discussed it. We got down on our knees and we prayed about it, and we determined before God that we were going to eliminate this from our lives because we were hurting one another as a result of it, and it wasn't going to get better, it was going to get worse. And so we agreed that we would help one another. It had gotten to be such a habit in our lives that we were sometimes unconscious when we did it. We were not even aware of the fact that we were being sarcastic. And so we had to call one another on it. We had to agree to do this. And we did. And it took us several weeks to finally get out of this habit. But since then, it has enriched our relationship. We have seen other couples who have fallen into this pattern, and when we're around them, sometimes it makes us uncomfortable because we see what they are doing to one another. We have seen this sweep through whole families. We used to have a family come and visit us from time to time. It was mom, dad, two kids, and grandma. And they had developed a pattern of sarcastic slams and remarks that had gone, that by this time went way beyond the arena of humor. It was now designed and directed with barbed arrows. And man, when you got caught in the middle of that, it got very uncomfortable. Fortunately, the Lord got a hold of the wife's heart on this issue. She began to realize what it was doing to their family. She stopped it herself. It caught on. And now it's a delight to be with them. It's really fun to be around them because their manifestation of love toward one another is very obvious. Now, maybe you can handle this. We can't. And so we've eliminated. But it's something you need to think about and examine if you have developed this particular habit of sarcasm. A second never is never criticize or correct him or her in public. Never criticize or correct him or her in public. Now, Carol and I, as she has mentioned and as I've referred to, are quite different. For instance, she is a writer. Carol's mother was a writer, and I've learned something about writers over the years, and one of the things about them is that they tend to exaggerate certain things. And Carol has a habit of occasionally exaggerating, or if she doesn't know something, she'll just kind of let it come out. Like if it's supposed to be some kind of a percentage involved, well, maybe it's 80%. You know, 80 is as good as 70, huh? Or 50. I love her for it. One time we had a conference up at Green Lake, Wisconsin. It was all men's deal. And we had 986 men there. And it was really a fantastic Thanksgiving weekend conference. The Lord really blessed, and I got home and I was telling Carol all about the conference, and I mentioned that there were 986 men there. I'm a detail individual. I'm a perfectionist in certain ways, and so 986 meant something to me. And so I related that to her, among other things. A week or two later, I was eavesdropping on a conversation that Carol was having with some other gals, telling them all about this fabulous conference the guys had up at Green Lake over Thanksgiving weekend, and she went on and raving about this, and she said, and there were just over 1,000 men there. Now, 986 is not just over 1,000. It's just under 1,000. Now, folks, I had a very significant and important decision to make at that point. To butt in and correct Carol in front of her friends and tell her and them, well now honey, don't get carried away, it was just under 1,000. In fact, girls, if you really want to know the truth, it was 986. Or to take what I call the long view, the 20-year look. In other words, now what difference is it really going to make 20 years from now to that little group of women whether it was just over 1,000 or just under 1,000. And people, I have come to the conclusion that the 20-year look in most cases means it won't make any difference at all. Never correct or criticize him or her in public. Now, if it's an important issue, and this has happened, when I get home or when we get home and it's something that I've done or that she's done, we will by ourselves talk about it, but not in public. We all have a tendency to exaggerate, to overstate, to tell it differently? How many times have you been in a little group of husbands and wives, and it's storytelling time? And the party has gotten kind of humorous, and she is coaxing him to tell his favorite story, and he's told it a dozen times, and it's really a good one, and it's his story, and it's the perfect setting, and so she's encouraging him and urging him and coaxing him, and finally he gives in, and he starts telling his story, and he gets one paragraph into it, and he changes something. I mean, it's his story. He's got the right to change it any way he wants to, huh? But he changes something. He elaborates, and she says, "Now, honey, remember, don't get carried away," and she corrects him and tells him how he did it the last time. And so he says, "Okay, fine." And he goes on, and then he leaves something out. It's his story. He's got the right to leave it out if he wants to. But not according to her opinion. And so she chimes in, and she says, "Well, now, honey, don't forget what you said last time." Oh, yeah, okay. About the third time she does that, he turns to her and says, "You tell it." Or he just clams up. Now, we're all guilty of that type of thing. But folks, we need to be conscious of it. We need to be diligent. Never correct or criticize him or her in public. You see, I'm the president of the Carol Mayhall fan club. Now, I know she's got some other fans, but I am the president. Now, the reason that I am the president of the Carol Mayhall fan club is not just because she is a fantastic mother for our daughter, or a godly woman, or a writer of a book, or a good cook, which she is, she's fabulous, or good looking. The reason that I'm the president of the Carol Mayhall fan club, folks, is because I love her. And because I love her, I want her to look good in the eyes of other people. And therefore, we work at this habit of not criticizing or correcting one another in public. It's a terrible habit to fall into. Let me mention one other thing and then we'll quit. If you've been married very long, you are very much aware that it's not usually the big thing that happens that causes the continual irritation. Usually you can face up to the big problem that you face, and you can come to grips with it and resolve it together. The thing that causes irritation between most husbands and wives is a lot of little things that pile up one on top of the other over a period of time until finally they pile up so much that there is a blow-up. When we were engaged, we had a very stormy courtship. We broke our engagement three times. Friends of ours thought we would never make it. In fact, they began to wonder if we were even designed for one another. But a great deal of the problems that we had during that 3 years that we were engaged had to do with little things that irritated us about one another. Actions, wording, phraseology, intonation, inflection, actions, little dicky things that would just go on, and finally we'd have a blow up, and Carol would give me back the ring, and you know, I'd keep it, and we'd be unengaged for a period of time, and then we'd realize we couldn't stand it without each other, and so I'd ask her again if she'd marry her, and she'd say yes, and I gave her back the ring, and that happened three different times. That ring has traveled a lot of miles. Well, during this period of time, we realized that there was something wrong here, and we needed some good advice, and so we went to a man that we both respected very highly, Dr. Brooks, who was the dean of students at Wheaton College at that time, and a very godly man, and we walked into his office, one afternoon and sat down and began to pour out our story to him. And it mostly had to do with these little things that we didn't like about one another, that irritated us about one another. Things that we did that the other one didn't appreciate, things we said, the way we said things. And so he listened very patiently, very understandingly, and then said, if Mrs. Brooks and I, they'd been married some 30 years at that time, he said, if Mrs. Brooks and I, early in our relationship with each other, had not learned to forgive and forget the little things that irritated us about one another, we never would have made it this far. And he went on to explain how they handled that type of thing. That if it was the type of thing that was, it could be looked at from a humorous standpoint and could just be overcome by forgetting it and forgiving, they tried to approach it that way. If it was something that could not be forgotten, they would get it out and talk about it. And here again, it enters in the matter of communications. And so they learned to get these things out if they could not forgive them and forget them. Now, that was a great lesson for us, and we began to try and put it into practice. Now, the type of things I'm talking about is this. Guys, where do you leave your dirty underwear when you take it off? Where do you hang your pajamas during the day? You wear them at night. Where do you hang them during the day? Does your wife have a clothes hamper and that's where the dirty clothes are supposed to go? Do you have a hook in the closet that's where your pajamas are supposed to go? Or is it a lot less time consuming to drape them over the back of the chair in the bedroom? Or just to leave your dirty underwear stacked in the corner? Or to forget to take the garbage out on Thursday morning before you go to work? Or to continually neglect those little things around the house that she has asked you to do. You know the do list that she keeps for you? By the way, how many of you guys are up to date on that do list right now? Let me see your hands. Well, two or three of you. Good. That's not bad in a crowd this size. Those are the types of things. Now, the types of things that would get to me, for instance, those are the things that get to Carol. You know, really big deals. Huh? Really big deals. We used to have a shower that had two faucets rather than one, you know, that operated the thing. And once in a while, I'd go to reach in and expect to get a hold of a nice, cold, shiny faucet to turn the water on before I got into the shower and get the temperature just right. And instead, I would get a hold of a wet, soggy wash rag hung over both of those faucets. Boy, I don't know of anything that's more irritating than that. And then I'd find out Carol had just taken a shower an hour or so before. Well, after that happened several times, it was one of those things that we had to talk about. It wasn't something I could just forget about. And so anymore, she wrings it out now and hangs it on the towel rack. We used to have a closet that was one of these sliding door varieties, you know, and you could only get in half of it at one time. I'd go to get in my side of the closet and I'd get the door halfway open and it wouldn't go any further. And always at that point in time, I want something way in the middle, you know, and I had to have the door all the way open to get it. And I'd push the door, and it just wouldn't go open. And I'd look down, and here, very neatly stacked, were about three pairs of shoes and slippers, only they weren't quite all the way in the closet, just out enough to stop the door from going open. And so I'd very lovingly go over, you know, and kick them in the closet. Or I couldn't begin to tell you how many times we would come to that closet at the same time to get something. And you can only open half of it at once. For the life of me, I couldn't understand why in the world she had to pick that time to get in her side of the closet. It irritated me. Until I began to look at it with a little bit of humor. And realized that it was kind of funny. It wasn't anything to get mad about. It was something to laugh at. And so from that point on, whenever it would happen, and there she would be, and here I would be, I would very graciously be gentlemanly and bow to her wishes and let her go first. I mean, that's what's supposed to happen, isn't it? It's a woman's world. Of course, the one thing that really bugged me is I would take off two socks, dutifully put them in the dirty clothes hamper, or down, now we have a clothes chute. And then, you know, what you expect is for it to go through the washing machine and the dryer and back in the drawer, and there's two left. No way. No way. And I would wait for that other sock to show up. And I would wait. Well, we had to talk about that one. At first, I thought we had a Maytag washer that ate socks. Carol's got her own scheme on how to handle that one now. My inventory of socks has gone up somewhat, but she just hangs on to one sock now instead of putting it back in my drawer until the other one shows up. And eventually it does. It finds its way home by hook or by crook. And I tell you, I've had more advice on that one, how to solve that one. Some of you gals are absolutely ingenious how you resolved that one. I've had several of you comment on it to me, but the little things that can irritate us, huh? If we can't look at it humorously and just overcome it in that way, if we can't just forget about it and accept the person for the way they are, that is the way she is, and I love her because of it, then we've got to get it out and talk about it, gang. Discuss it together, and if there are changes and adjustments that need to be made on one side or the other, then we've got to be willing to do that. And sometimes that is the only alternative we have. But we've got to talk about it. And who has the responsibility for initiating that kind of communication? I do, as the head of my home. Well, let's pray. We're a little bit over time. Father, we thank you for this good time we've had together. We trust that some of the things that have been shared will be meaningful and practical to those who are here. And Father, the thing that Carol and I would ask you to do in our lives as well as in each couple's life here is to enrich their marriage, to draw them closer to one another and closer to you as the years go by, and that they will fall more deeply in love with one another and with you, and that they might have an exciting time in developing this relationship down through the years. We thank you for the privilege of this wonderful thing that you've given to us in being able to enter into it with excitement and with thrilling experiences that await us, this thing we call marriage. So we thank you for it and ask your blessing on us that we might honor you in our homes and in our relationship. For we pray in Christ's name. Amen.